Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. It is Wednesday, March 26th, and we are continuing a public hearing on House Bill 5030, which is the Department of Human Services, Health Services. And we are continuing with a presentation that we began on yesterday with Bob Nickel, representing Health Services, Mr. Cast, Barry Cast, and we also have Mr. Naughton back with us. And how would you like to proceed?
Madam Chair, Barry Cast, Mr. Nickel will proceed with his presentation.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, day two, and the plan is to move quickly into how the system has been performing, which is, I understand it was the second question that the committee had asked us to speak to. And unless there are some other questions, I'll just immediately move in that direction.
No other questions, Mr. Nickel. Just a reminder to all of us that we have Rosie and her offspring waiting for contributions. So we'll just be mindful of our acronyms again today. The chair would want me to say that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, again, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm acting administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. How the system is performing. Just a few preparatory remarks. I think there are probably as many opinions about how the system is performing in A&D and mental health and gambling addiction as there are people. I can't pretend to have the only set of views on this, but I do want to spend some time walking through some numbers that tell us at least the basics of access, how many people we're getting to. But then beyond that, what is the quality and some of the outcomes of those services that are being provided? And I also want to share with the committee some steps we've taken in the last 2 years to move toward more consistent performance measurement approaches and talk about some of the plans we have for that. Let me again start with alcohol and drug treatment services. In 1999, we served 58,000 people. And paralleling the growth in Oregon and largely as a result of the additional resources available through the Oregon Health Plan, we've increased that number to 67,000, almost 70,000, as Barry Cast mentioned yesterday, I believe. We're beginning to implement performance measures. The first steps are being taken as we were required to do according to a budget note to begin moving toward performance-based contracting using those. Without walking through all of the details, if you want to look on page 4-14, you'll see the alcohol and drug treatment performance model. It's also referred to as a logic model. I'm not sure exactly whether the term logic model adds a lot.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Wesley.
Madam Vice Chair, what page are we on and where is it, seeing as how I can never find it in these books?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I'm working out of the document that has the program overview for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and it's okay. And it's 4-14.
Thank you, Representative Westland. Please continue.
Thank you.
As you can see by the chart there, kind of a complicated thing, but basically it describes an overall goal or a high-level goal. This is a goal, in this case, that reduces the negative consequences of behavioral health disorders. This is something that probably the alcohol and drug treatment system alone can't entirely be responsible for, but it's certainly one that the system needs to contribute in a major way toward. High-level outcomes, as you can see next, are the percentage of clients who reduce their use of publicly supported services. In other words, the idea isn't to see how many people we can get dependent on public services, but to keep people moving through. And percent of clients exiting treatment who are employed. part of the process that will be involved here is setting some benchmarks so that we know where we're at now given the level of care and level of services that we have available and where that will be given whatever resources we have to work with in the next biennium. Just to summarize, and be happy to try to answer questions about that particular model and some of more of the details, but I think some of the more critical features of it are that 90%, and this is on page 415, 4-15, and 4-16, over 90% of the clients who enter treatment after they've had a positive assessment, in other words, once it's been determined by an assessment that they have an alcohol and drug problem, 90% of those people do, in fact, enter our treatment programs. And of those people, 64% stay in treatment 90 days or longer. The benchmark of 90 days or longer is, according to the literature, a good proxy for knowing whether people are really going to benefit from treatment or not. In other words, there's enough evidence in a body of literature that says that if people are in treatment for less than 3 months, it's not going to be as effective. So that's why the 90-day marker was chosen. And 64%, as I mentioned, stay in treatment 90 days or longer. And nearly 70% show reduced use after treatment. This is by self-report, by the way, and I think there was quite a bit of discussion at the last session about how your analysis fits into this picture, what the relative value of your analysis is versus self-report, and later on, if hopefully we'll have a little bit of time to walk through the budget notes. There was a budget note that required us to look into that issue, and I think that we have a clearer picture this biennium about the role and usefulness of your analysis.
Senator Carter.
One question, please, and thank you for your report. In looking at your treatment model, or your performance model, and under the high-level outcomes, well, I think it's very laudable to reduce the number of clients who reduce their use of publicly supported services. I'm wondering how realistic it is given the number of people, or maybe my assumption, I'm assuming that most of the people who are in the care, in government's care, are not people who could take care of themselves but for some steady job that they already have. So how realistic for us to believe that those numbers are going to change? Because I think that has everything to do with planning and public policy, and for the legislature who has not done a good job of funding mental health in the first place, and you know how I feel about that. Is that a realistic goal?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think that's a very good question. Part of what we're talking about here is the alcohol and drug treatment system, and later we'll talk about the mental health treatment system. But even in the mental health treatment, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here,
yes,
I think we've underestimated, given the right kinds of supports, the number of people who have severe and persistent mental illnesses who could work, and I'll get into that a little bit later. In the alcohol and drug treatment area, many, many of the people are working, and it's a more of a short-term model of treatment in the alcohol and drug treatment world.
I apologize because I'm so much thinking mental health that I did not look at the top piece of it. Because in a society like ours, where we don't do a good job of educating ourselves and educating society about about mental illness itself, I just have some concerns, Madam Chair, that we make sure that we are looking at the reality of numbers so that this body, whether we're on this panel here today or here or not, but so that good numbers will come so we can face the reality of taking care of the mentally ill in the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you for recognizing the complexity of this issue. Mm-hmm. I want to add to what Bob said and note that treatment for both chemical dependency and mental health also contributes to keeping people moving into employment and to regaining custody of their children. There are a number of ways in which these services have been effective and which the legislature has recognized the interrelationship. And one of the reasons we had a successful program in self-sufficiency over so many years and reduce caseload so dramatically is because we finally made those kinds of treatment services available to people who had become dependent on state services. So it's not just about dependence on the treatment environment, but also what treatment means for an individual's ability to work, to have social relationships, to perform the responsibilities they have as citizens and as parents and so forth. And that the evidence for that is partly that in discussing where the state ought to be investing, we get a lot of support from law enforcement, from the child welfare community, from the Ramona Foley, and who runs our children, adults, and families program, where our self-sufficiency programs are located, because they recognize that fact.
Thank you. And Bob, I didn't mean to take you out of context. I was reading something else. Excuse me.
Please continue.
There are many more features of this that I could walk into in detail, but given the limitations on time, I want to be able to talk about some of the other ways of assessing how some of the programs are doing. We have some fairly incredible programs throughout the state, and it's not my intention just to stand up here and sit up here and advertise one model program after another, but there are some really incredible programs that I do want to call your attention to. One of those is the integrated treatment courts for youth and families, and we have these in, I believe, 7 counties. And we took a look at 6 months of data for 72 of the youth who were involved in those programs at that point. And 85% of those kids showed a reduction in their use of illegal substances, and there was a 63% reduction in the number of juvenile arrests. And I think it's just another example of the fact that treatment, if it's done properly and provided to people, really does make an impact on other kinds of programs. It's not 100% success rate, and I think we error greatly if we try to claim unrealistic success rates. But again, if you compare it to the treatment success rates for other chronic disorders, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, it really looks very respectable. In fact, many of the times exceeds what you would expect from those kinds of treatments. We're now sharing county-by-county data, and we're moving towards sharing program and provider level of data on each of these performance measures so that the counties and the providers can begin to compare themselves against benchmarks and against statewide averages. So I think, again, this is an example of the steps that we're taking and informed by a number of the discussions last session about how we need to move forward in that area. I want to mention prevention. Most of our prevention efforts are directed towards youth and adults with alcohol and drug problems, although we are beginning to look at how we can do a better job in the area of mental health profession or prevention. But in the area of alcohol and drug prevention, we've also developed a similar kind of model, a logic model, if you will, and I believe that's on page 4-16. And it uses a similar approach. Here, the key indicator is reducing the number of eighth graders who report using alcohol and drugs in the past 30 days. The focus of prevention activities is in 4 main areas: communities, families, schools, and individuals, peers, in order to reduce the kind of risks that are fairly clearly spelled out in a good deal of scientific literature about use. The numbers look like this. In 1998, 36.6% of the kids, eighth grade kids, had reported using alcohol and drugs in the previous 30 days. By the year 2000, that had dropped to 30.4%. And last year, it edged slightly up to 31.4%. These compare fairly typically with what you see around the country in terms of other kinds of state's efforts in this area. All 36 counties in Oregon are involved and receive some funds for prevention, and they use locally developed targets and evidence-based practices. I might add here that that's another area in which I think there is opportunity to use funds even more efficiently than we have by moving toward those prevention practices that have a good scientific base and an evidence-based practice to them. We have a meeting scheduled in a couple of weeks to get stakeholders together. We want to talk about what our mutual understanding of the research literature in this area is, so that whatever dollars we have, we steer them as much as possible towards scientific and evidence-based practices in prevention.
Bob, has work been done, or has any thoughts been given to linking some of the tobacco and alcohol prevention work with your nurses in the schools?
Madam Chair, I believe that some of that work is going on. I would have to go back and get more detail about exactly what we're doing, but I'd be happy to get that information for you.
It just seems to me, if we're targeting young people, and that's a resource of linking to, you know, the school nurses and those who actually see them, and also your school counselors in that environment. So I'd be interested in see what we are doing and what we can do.
Madam Chair, I can add that we are working closely with the Department of Education. In a couple of weeks, I know we're reviewing all of the prevention plans with Department of Education staff, so I'll bring forward some more of that information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley and then Representative Bates.
Thank you. That raises the issue of how many school nurses do we have left, and it also raises the issue and concern about the school-based health clinics that we look to deliver some of the services that we're talking about. So just maybe a reality check.
Madam Chair, if I may for just a moment, if you can turn back to page 2-6 in the previous section, you can see a differentiation in the governor's balanced budget between prevention and treatment investments. And I think it's not too difficult to calculate that of the incredible budget that we have, less than 1% is invested in treatment for alcohol and drug and mental health disorders. And I think this is an area where, over the years, the technology of prevention has dramatically improved. A lot of the work in alcohol and drug prevention has been done here in the Northwest out of the University of Washington. We have great technology. Each county knows what their risk factors are. Most of the planning is done at the local level. And in response to your question, at the local level, in fact, those issues, tobacco, alcohol and drug abuse, mental health, with respect to kids, is much more integrated than even we are at the state level. So we're making progress at the state level. The local communities are ahead of us in this respect. But clearly there's an issue of investment here. And it's not a question of shifting between the two, but of deciding what the right balance is, as I discussed on Monday.
Thank you. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the treatment side of alcohol and drug abuse, I would like to have a little bit more information than what's been provided here. I'm sure you probably have, but you try to be concise. I'd like to have an idea of how often your analysis was used in a given treatment program, how random it was, what length of time those programs were talking about. Were you talking about 6 months, 3 months, 5 years, short-term, long-term? It's a very difficult thing to measure, obviously, to see if you've been successful, and it's also sometimes difficult to say what success is. Being clean, sober, and off all drugs is obviously the answer. The question is, for how long? Is it lifelong recovery or is it not? But I'd like to have a little more data on that, see what you've done as far as starting a year analysis program to really test this situation and see how far you've gone, knowing that alcohol is the greatest drug of abuse and really can't be checked by year analysis. I'd like to see what you're doing as far as that's concerned, also to check for how effective your alcohol programs are also. Thank you.
I'm sure Representative Bates, I would just like to confirm, yeah, we'll look at what our data can tell us on that. I do want to say that the budget note was very helpful, I think, for me in thinking through the issues related to how we do your analysis, when we do it. As you mentioned, different drugs have different retention rates in the system, and so for alcohol in particular, you're absolutely correct that my nose may not be good enough, but most people's noses are good enough to know whether someone's been drinking in the last 8 or 9 hours, particularly if it's any amount at all. The other drugs vary in their retention times, and we have to be very aware of each of those. And I know that our drug providers, our alcohol and drug treatment providers, are very aware of those kind of things. What I learned about self-report is there are reliable ways to do it, but you have to approach it correctly. Having been an alcohol and drug counselor at one time in my career in Medford, I know that if you ask the question the wrong way, you're going to get a very befuddled and unclear answer. Well, a clear answer that's not correct, I should say. On the other hand, there are ways to ask it, which increase the chances of getting a more accurate answer. I think my own view is that some combination of urinalysis and sophisticated approaches to self-report is probably the direction that we can most productively move in, particularly with some limited resources, which we know we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I want to emphasize, too, that we're working very carefully with the 9 federally recognized tribes, and there's about $1 million of prevention dollars that are apportioned out to each of the tribes. We have a very capable staff person who works a great deal with the tribes on those issues. We are also working in the area of fetal alcohol syndrome and working carefully with the tribes and others on that very critical issue. I want to mention one program in the prevention area. It also just happens to be from Southern Oregon, from Josephine County, which is called the College Dreams Program. It's one that has received national recognition in the last 6 months for an approach to mentoring youth, helping them see, choosing kids who are at particular potential risk. In other words, kids whose grades have begun dropping in the last 6 months or year, and focusing on those kids, hooking them up with people who have been successful, talking with them about the role of alcohol and drug use in their life and how that'll help or hinder their attempts to get into college, to get regular jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to mention that that's a program that the state, all of us, have a reason to be proud of. I'd like to move into mental health treatment. And I think in the mental health area, there are probably the greatest number of questions and probably the greatest continuum of opinions, if you will, about whether...
Madam Chair.
Representative Westland.
Or do you want a specific page?
These will be...
419.
Thank you.
419?
Or is it 427?
419.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I believe this starts on 419, 4-19. Before I go into the performance measure model, and I won't do that in great detail, I do want to talk about just the issue of access. How are we doing? In 1998, we estimate that we served about 86,000 people. Actually, it's not an estimate. It's based on our data systems, and we have 3 of those. I believe we went into considerable detail 2 years ago on how we do those counts. I won't try to describe that in detail now, but we've moved from 86,000 people served in mental health. This includes kids, adults, and older adults to 127,000 in 2001. One of the things that I thought would be helpful in thinking about how the mental health system has been performing is to take a little bit more than just a 2-year look back. There was a 1988 Governor's Commission on Inpatient Psychiatric Services. Barry Cast was actually the staff person to that at the time. A lot of government reports end up in the dustbin. This is not one that did. It really served as the blueprint for where we've been over the last 15 years. There were a number of recommendations. What I found in looking back over it, and I did this not so much in preparation for talking with the legislature because I didn't know at the time I would be doing this, but we had a state hospital review group, and I thought it would be helpful as that group looked at where we're at with our state hospitals and our community system to see how we had done in terms of accomplishing the goals of that 1988 Governor's Commission. I don't believe we had time to include this in your booklet, so if you're looking for it, I don't think we had time to put it in here. I can get copies of it to the committee if you'd like to see more of the detail. Dr. Mazerhart and I worked on this together, and one of the real keys that has been accomplished from that is that we've really been able to maintain the state hospital census. and to a large extent the costs of the state hospitals, which is one of the real risks for the state legislature in terms of not letting the costs of the state hospital get completely out of control. We really probably can never afford to go back to having 5,000 people in our state hospitals again. That would be financially completely infeasible. So we have been able to work at levels that have not really increased much, except probably in the forensic area, and we can talk about that in a little bit as well. In order to reduce state hospital census and to maintain that, there were a number of very key program ideas that came out of that report. One of them was to move all of our acute care into community hospitals. I believe yesterday I mentioned that we have about 15 or 16 community hospital units, mostly on the western side of the mountains, who are doing now all of the immediate acute care emergency admissions. We used to do all of that by sending people hundreds of miles from home to Pendleton, to Portland, to Damish when we had that at Wilsonville, and to Salem. We now are moving toward about 6,000 acute care admissions each year. 10 years ago, that number was about 2,000. So you can see that in that period of time, we've actually dealt with what was widely viewed as a major problem at that time, and that was getting hospital beds for people. I don't believe that we've entirely solved that problem, but we've really increased access. We've done that in a cost-effective way because these community hospitals are able to use Medicaid funding rather than state general fund, which is normally the case in the state hospitals. And so we've reduced the length of stay, we hospitalize people closer to home, and the cost per episode is the same or, in most cases, less than it would be if we actually hospitalized people for acute psychiatric episodes hundreds of miles from home. Those lengths of stay were running 40 to 60 days instead of the 11 to 12 days that we average in our community hospitals. I think if there was nothing else that the system did in the last 15 years to respond to a very serious set of concerns that existed in the late 80s about our state hospitals, we have accomplished that.
Bob, and I'm going to ask you to bring this back to us because you probably don't have it today. But since we're talking about mental health and the hospital and the community services, at the e-board, there was a request for the agency to report back to us on the mental health organizations, and specifically the issue at the board was the reserves that were being held. So at some point in your presentation, I would appreciate it if you would bring the results of that report to this body.
Madam Chair, we'll do that.
Thank you.
During the last 15 years, we've also created a whole layer of intensive services that never existed before, which was part of the problem with the overcrowding at Damish, was there was basically the community and a few regular kinds of group homes and the state hospital, and there was really nothing much in between. And many of the patients who got stuck, frankly, in the state hospital system, particularly at Damish, really needed something beyond a normally staffed, regular kind of group home and hospital level of care. We now have about 580 beds of that. That's almost entirely funded through Medicaid and the state general fund match. We call that the extended care system, and then there are some programs called enhanced care facilities which serve people who are older and who would otherwise be in the geropsychiatric units. I suspect that most people have not heard much about these programs. And I suggest, too, that it's probably because they're working. And one of the phenomena that I've noticed is that when programs work, they usually don't get very much attention. And would be happy at some point to provide the committee with additional information. I've asked for a report on our extended care projects, and it's almost ready for release. But it talks about those 580 beds, which I think are very effectively used. During 2001 and 2003, we've also demonstrated some new ways of serving particularly children and adults who might otherwise take up very costly state hospital beds. We moved the, as we call it, the little kids or the 13 and under age kids out of the state hospital in the last biennium. We've created a program called the Secure Children's Inpatient Program. It's operated up in Portland by Trillium, and it's been in operation now for a little bit over a year, I believe. So we now have only two wards at the state hospital for adolescents, and they're for older adolescents, 14 to 17. We also created a new service in the last year and a half called Post-Acute Intermediate Treatment Services. Again, since I don't want to use acronyms, there is an acronym that's used frequently, but we'll just stick with Post-Acute Intermediate Treatment Services for now. We have two such facilities. One is...
Do you think Rosie's going to go away?
Madam Chair, I actually am planning to contribute some dollars to Rosie, but I just don't, I would prefer to do it on my own voluntary. We have a 16-bed facility in the Portland area called the Telecare Recovery Center. This is a 16-bed facility. It serves people who would otherwise be going to the state hospital. Usually those people's length of stay is anywhere between 120 and 180 days or longer. This facility is unique in that it establishes a clinically driven length of stay projection of 30, 60, or 90 days. It's got Medicaid funding in it, so although the actual dollar cost per day is a little richer than it is in the state hospital, the state general fund cost is about half of what it would cost the state hospital bed for that same patient. And these are patients who would all otherwise go to the hospital. They do not need, and the people who go to these post-acute intermediate treatment services beds, they don't need hospital level of care. They don't need that high level of medical care. But it is 24-hour staff. There's a half-time psychiatrist. There's 24-hour nursing. So it's a very high level of care, but it's considered non-hospital or residential care.
What's the difference in the per-patient cost?
Madam Chair, the cost for a state hospital bed for that same patient would be about $396 a day. The state general fund cost for the post-acute intermediate treatment services is about $188 a day. It's matched with the other 60%, so you actually have a $453 a day program, but of that, only 40% is state general fund.
Is there a longer length of stay at the state hospital than if it's in the community?
Madam Chair, I should hasten to add that the average length of stay for this telecare recovery center in the similar set of beds we have in Lane County is now 48 days. So if you figure out the cost per episode, it's approximately one quarter and maybe even less than what it would take to serve the same patient. These are civilly committed patients.
Mm-hmm.
These are not the forensics beds, although I'm not sure that the model is entirely unadaptable to the forensic population. But right now we've been using it to serve civilly rather than criminally.
So that same patient in the state hospital would stay how long?
Madam Chair, the average length of stay for people on the wards that these people would go to otherwise is between 90, 120, and about 180 days. And again, I can get more exact length of stay data. We do select, I want to hasten to say, we do select people, and there are some patients who really do need to go to the state hospital. So, but we estimate that 50 to 75% of the people that we've been otherwise sending to the state hospital who are civilly committed and need longer-term care can be handled in this type of program.
One other question.
Senator Carter.
What do we know today, Barry, that we didn't know 10 years ago, since you can make the distinction between those, between those that need to go to the hospital versus those that we can't take care of in the community?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, Bob can give you a lot of detail about this, but let me just because we've been working together for 12 or 13 years to achieve the results we've achieved, is that among other things, we have advanced our understanding of community care and the participation of high-level organizations that can help us with this. I mean, a dozen years ago, we didn't have these kinds of opportunities available to us. In addition, we recognize that to constrain the growth of the state hospital, we needed a special gatekeeping function. 10 years ago, we didn't have that function. Today, we have a staff called the Extended Care Management Unit that looks at every patient and makes good clinical decisions. There's nurses and a physician and caseworkers in that unit that help us steer each patient to the right level of care. And then finally, there's been a tremendous advance in pharmaceutical technology in the past dozen years, and it's hard for me to recall the days in the 80s when we didn't even have clozapine, which clozapine was probably the most important development that we had, and Oregon was the first state to make a significant commitment to the new atypical antipsychotic. So the combination of technology, better casework, and a community that was willing to work with us and develop innovative models has produced a lot of change. And with that, we've been able to reduce the size of the state hospital civil wards and constrain it. And now what we're concerned about, as I think Bob was implying a few minutes ago, is that as these budgetary effects come in, we want to be cognizant of the risk there is in inflating hospital costs and not responding to the needs of people who really don't need to go there.
Madam Chair, I recall from our discussions in the audit committee that well, make a couple of key points, I think, in what you're talking about. You may have made them, I may have missed them. In the state hospital setting, we are not able to get Medicaid match, I don't believe. You have to go to a community setting or a setting of less than 16 beds. And that's been a big plus as far as reducing cost also. And there's been a real movement, both the hospital and the communities, to try to decipher which patients can, in fact, go to a little lesser care facility. But it's been a very difficult transition, I think, from what I've heard for many counties and for the state hospital times, trying to make the decision of what patient truly is safe to be there, both from the patient's point of view and the public's point of view. And that's still something that appears to be something that's in transition. Some counties saying, yes, we can take this particular type of patient. Other counties being a little less likely to take, they're a little more concerned about taking that type of patient as they walk into this new area. Is that a good summation of these changes?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, I think it is. I would say that the 10 years of experience we've had now with the Extended Care Management Unit and the Extended Care Services has taught us more. I think that there is no escaping the idea that there are some risks that we take when we downsize state hospitals. There are advantages to doing it, too, and for every risk that we take, I think there are more advantages in terms of allowing some people who we before thought might be hopeless cases to actually get a life. And so I think that we have to balance those things very carefully. I didn't talk at all, and I'm going to just do this very briefly. The way in which we develop these 580 beds, I think, is interesting and bears on this point. We didn't force any counties to come to the table and help us with this, although we did have goals that we set, and we knew that there were budget issues riding on whether we could reduce the size of the state hospital or prevent it from getting any larger and use funds in the community rather than state hospital beds. But most of the projects that we've developed have been based on individual people. In other words, the dollars really followed a certain named set of patients into the community. And that's a model that we've talked about as being the route to go for many years. That's part of why I can't describe to you a typical extended care management project. They are all different. There's one for dually diagnosed adults in Northwest Portland. There's one for people who have medical complications in addition to their psychiatric problem in a facility in Medford. It's a medically enhanced adult foster care. There are intensive supported housing projects. I mean, I could go on and on. I won't belabor the point. But these projects have been developed with individual people in mind. And because of that, we place higher risk people in higher security facilities. We have six secure residential treatment facilities around the state. So we put the higher risk people in higher intensive care.
Senator Carter.
Just a comment. I was here in the 80s, so I know what it was like, and I just want to take this time to give kudos to Barry, because he inherited a barracuda, especially when you look at the federal government's position and how many times we've been sued in the state. And to take that whole notion of, you know, de-warehousing and giving people dignity in this state has been wonderful, and you've been a good charge. So I just wanted to take time to say that, because I have been working with him since 85.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you very much. I do think that was I appreciate your regard for me, but I really think we did this together. And Bob's given you some of the programmatic side, but I want to recognize that we have caseloads in every other part of state government. We try to anticipate realistically how many children are going to be in school, how many people are going to be on income support, what the caseloads will be in child welfare. But it wasn't until the last couple of years that we've recognized that with population growth and with the nature of our society, there are caseloads in our state hospitals as well. And actually, George Naughton was the first to recognize in working with us from the Department of Administrative Services that we ought to be building that into the budget. Previously, though, for the past dozen years or so, we've come back to you at every emergency board saying our hospital's growing, we're crowding the state hospital, we can either build another ward or we can look to the community and see if there aren't alternatives, the kinds that Representative Bates has been talking about. And I think everyone has stepped up to the plate, the legislature, our community mental health programs, the private nonprofit community, to try to make a life in the community for people who in another generation would have, as you put it, been warehoused or been, I don't like that term because I think we do a lot of treatment at the state hospital. Maybe not 30 or 40 years ago, but I think we do today.
Thank you. And I use that with great respect, but quite frankly, there were some people who did not need to have been there, and I think to have given people the opportunity of dignity and life skill experiences, and to also wake up our society in terms of the whole issue of mental illness is something that I think going to community-based programs has done, and we need to continue to do an even greater job along those lines.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I agree, and I want to, this may be the good time to note that there is still a group of patients who believe that they do not need to be in a state hospital, and there is litigation currently pending on appeal about that very issue. Which maintains that if someone is in a state hospital doesn't need to be there, they have a right to a less restrictive placement. Often, though, for us, the restriction is on the capacity of the community to take more people. And it may be that we'll find ourselves in a legal environment in which we have to move that direction and don't have the resources to do so. This would be a very, very difficult it's awful to make policy in the courts as opposed to here in these chambers.
I couldn't agree with you more. I do have a question on the 6 secure facilities. Can you tell me where they're located around the state?
Madam Chair, yes. There is one in Josephine County called Hugo Hills. There are 2 in Lane County. One is called the Paul Wilson House. The other one is called the Heron Center. There are 2 regular secure treatment facilities in Portland run by Mental Health Partners. One is called Faulkner Place. The other one is called Arbor Place. And there is the Telecare Recovery Center. And is that 5 or 6?
That's 6.
6. Okay.
And where is that one located?
That one's in Gresham.
So you have 3 Multnomah County and 2 in Lane and 1 in Josephine.
I'm sure that's correct.
I'm just trying to look at the statewide landscape. Thank you.
Let me move on to talk a little bit about the civil commitment data that we have. Civil commitment is obviously a very controversial area, and each session that I've been around here, there are bills that are introduced, and it's very usually you get a full house, you have a lot of opinions about it. The fact is that we have a fairly stable rate per capita of civil commitments, and this is what happens when a court decides that a person, because of their mental illness, is dangerous to themselves, others are unable to meet their basic needs. In the past 2 years, we've civilly committed about 1,600 people. These are almost virtually all adults. But I think the important thing to recognize is that for each of those persons who's been civilly committed, 7 or 8 other people started down the process. In other words, they had a 2-party petition filed which alleged that they were mentally ill, or the police picked them up and they were placed on a hospital hold or a non-hospital hold. My estimation is that if you do the math there, you end up with between about 11,000 and 14,000 lives were viewed as being in some degree of jeopardy at some point. And seven out of eight of those people, approximately, were able to be diverted to other kinds of things so they didn't have to be forced into treatment against their will. I think we all would like to minimize the number of people who have to be forced into treatment. We want to save that only for those situations in which we can't figure out another way to do it. The reason we can divert that many people is because we have had a good public safety net and we've had other mental health services. About half of those people usually have Medicaid or some other eligibility, but about half the people who come to our attention in the middle of a major psychiatric crisis are not connected anywhere. They don't have funding. And so part of what we have is a system that is able to absorb those people into some outpatient care, sometimes for fairly intensive care, to get them back on their meds or, in some cases, to start them on medications for the first time or to help them with housing, with other supports that they might need. So I'm fully aware that the counties probably come in for their share of criticism, and sometimes they've earned it, and sometimes they haven't. In this case, I think we have to recognize that the community mental health system has been functioning quite well for a long time in the area of civil commitment and trying to really emphasize getting people into voluntary care rather than involuntary treatment.
Madam Chair? Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Mr. Nickel, given the budget environment that we are in, and again, I'm just needing to do a reality check here. Are we not jeopardizing the ability to provide an inpatient bed for a person who may be civilly or criminally committed? Are we going to get to a point where that resource isn't there because some other things have happened that prevent that resource from being available?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that is one of the risk areas that I think that we have to assess very carefully here through this session and into the next biennium. Without good case management care and good access to medications, we do run a risk that we're going to have more people to try to fit into a limited number of inpatient beds that we have in the state. We don't have too many inpatient beds. They're full almost all the time. I looked this morning, for example, at our state contract for indigent acute care in the Caremark hospitals, and we have a contract to buy 18 beds, and there were 27 patients in those beds this morning. Now, that number fluctuates up and down. The average is still somewhere around 20, 21 beds for the month of March, but you can see just from that example that we're really pressing the limits of the inpatient capacity that we were able to purchase.
What's the... not on a monthly basis, but if you took it on a longitudinal, let's say, on an annual basis, month by month, can you give us that kind of information? There's always just peaks and troughs when you're looking at analysis, and I think for this body, looking at the macro over a year's period of time would be helpful.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we can get that. I can tell you that it averages about 200 acute care beds purchased with some degree of public funds on any given day, and over a year's time, that's a fairly stable number. Where you see the fluctuation is in individual hospitals or day to day, but overall we're buying about 200 beds. But we'll get the ADP. There we go. I owe Rosie 25 cents. The average daily population.
Excuse me.
We have a excellent sergeant at arms here who really does keep track, and I bet you she'll tell you that acronym was used more than once.
And Rosie doesn't like change.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'll work on that.
For 2 days, you've been letting him get away with his 25
cents. Well, you see the sergeant on here. She wasn't here yesterday.
I don't like no change. I'll let him get away with it.
Madam Chair, just to finish out my comment to Senator Gordley's question, the immediate risk is probably going to be, can we hook people up with outpatient care? And then the following risk is, can we then, as time moves along, deal with the inpatient risk that we've got? So in my opinion, that's a very critical question that we'll need to talk probably more about.
And Madam Chair, if I may follow
Senator Gordley.
the question really goes to a broader issue. We have before us on page 420 the mental health treatment performance measure model, and I've been looking at that model as you've been talking about some of the accomplishments over the past 15 years, increased access, reducing length of stay, et cetera. But I'm wondering if you could also focus our attention on what are the indicators that we should be mindful of that the cuts we will be making have gone too far. Now, that's a discussion, Mr. Nickel, that you and I have had to some degree. But I think as we're talking now, and particularly with the performance measure model piece in front of us, we need to be mindful of the other piece. We're really talking about the diminishing of and the dismantling of a lot of what you've described that has been put in place over these past 15 years. So again, I just need to frame it. I need to frame the discussion in a way that makes sense for me, given where we are right now. Does that make sense?
I'm going to help Mr. Nichols out because each agency is requested to come in with not only their priority rankings, but with that priority rankings includes the impact on the various service areas. So you should be receiving, as we go through this process, from all of them, their priorities, the impact on the general fund, the federal funds, mm-hmm. the impact on program structure, so that we will have a clear picture as they frame these rankings. And I've asked each one of the agencies to do that kind of work for us so that it gives us really a broad picture of what happens if they're at this level or if they're at the second level or at the third level, so that we clearly can have an understanding of those implications, not only with what happens if you remove the general fund dollars, but what is the federal dollar impact and implication on the agency. Mm-hmm.
And Madam Chair, I really appreciate that clarification. As long as we're also talking about impacts, not just in terms of dollars and cents, but impacts on real people in real communities who are struggling with us to try to figure out how is this going to work as we move forward. Thank you.
Senator Carter, I know this is a whole conversation between us, but I mean, that brings up a very valid point. You know, I'm such a bottom-line person. I know you have to do things according to protocol. But I really don't want to sit up here and listen to this when this structure is not what is in place. Now, let's be realistic here. If these people are coming here to talk about a program that in a model that is working in each of the local communities, and we are deconstructing the makeup of these models, I mean, it is for naught as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to waste my time this way. And I realize I'm a member of the legislature and I need to be here. But if you're this department in your division is talking about a performance model, expected goals and outcomes, and we have diminished in terms of dollars and cents your ability to do this, I don't want to hear it. Now, that's just me. I'll just excuse myself with me, Madam Chair. No, you're not gonna. I know I'm getting ahead of myself. But Senator Gordley brings up an excellent point. I mean, are we selling people a bag of jokes here? Are we saying that we're going to do what we're hearing? And if we are not, you need to say to the legislature, you ain't doing it. I mean, the money isn't here to do this. That's all I'm saying, Bob. If it's here to do this so we can give these people a sense of hope about having a program or having a solid mental health model that is working in this state, a solid alcohol and drug model that's working in this state, then that's great. But if we've already taken the money and you can't do any of this stuff, if we're going to be dreamers, let me know I'm supposed to be a part of a dream, okay? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. And I know sometimes when we're thinking in terms of budget that it's easy to do that. But the fact is that the budget is being, as you know, mm-hmm. recrafted, and they're coming back with priorities based on the current revenue where we are. And their task is to take this overview that they had done prior to the last action that this body took. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to put this in perspective. This body took it.
That's right.
Based on that, we took it. They have been asked to come back to us, given the fiscal realities of where we are, in a priority order of what they can and cannot do.
So maybe I'm a little premature.
You're a little premature.
Okay.
And they need the opportunity to bring that information to us. It is my understanding, you know, I know that Ben's group is working on his piece, and we're all working in this building to come to a point of how we're going to budget and provide resources for these issues based on the priorities that come before us. And so I don't want to put them on the spot, because honestly and truly, they're working very diligently to get that information for us. In the interim, as you know, we do have to provide. We have members on this panel who have not had the benefit of knowing what exists, okay. what did exist, and what should exist.
Okay, Madam Chair, I apologize.
Well,
just tell me when I'm in a dream.
No, you're not in a dream.
Okay.
You're not in a dream.
Madam Chair, if I could just say one last thing, and please indulge me. We don't want to put these folks on the spot either if they come back to us to say, you have gone too far. We don't want to shoot the messenger, is what I need to say.
I don't think that any legislative body that comes, any agency that comes before us in this kind of budget environment, nor the citizens who come before us in this kind of budget environment, that we want to put them on the spot. I don't care whether it is the agency, the public, or even the members that sit up here. But also I have to say that this body does have a responsibility of balancing a budget. And your chair and you members, along with me, will talk about what we will do given the resources that we have based on the information that we receive collectively from not only these members but everybody in this building and the public, so that we can do a job of setting budget priorities. And that's our task. And which we will then make a recommendation. We hope and I think we pray a lot that the other budget committees will be as diligent to find some funds to assist us. You know, we sit here having the most difficult budget in this building. We have what we do affect lives throughout this state. And I think all of us who sit on this panel are extremely mindful of the task that we have at hand. And I said last session, as your chair, I was fortunate enough to be able to increase budgets. As your chair this session, I do not have that position. And this chair this time, I have to look at what we can do for the most neediest in our society. And things that, and it's difficult. I'm not going to kid any of us sitting up here. It is a difficult mission, both for the agency and both for us and both for the citizens. You know, all of our partners out there who work with us, the counties, the providers. You know, I said when we started this, we're all in this boat. Mm-hmm. And it's not a boat that I think that we will enjoy by the time we get out of this building. And so I think we need to be very mindful that we are going to work together collectively. I don't think it's ever happened before in this building where we have taken our partners to work in the evenings at night to try to make sure we're going to do the best job that we can for the citizens of Oregon, given the resources that we have.
Madam Chair, can I just say something?
Yes, you may.
I appreciate very much the position that we are all in, and we are in this boat together. But here, let me just say to you what would be helpful to me, Madam Chair, as we go through this. If it would be helpful to me if they were to, if Bob or whomever is before us, were to say, this is the model that we've been operating on. But due to budget cuts, we aren't going to be able to. You know, it needs,
we'll get there.
It needs to be framed. That's all I'm saying, because I'm thinking, I might not need to. I need to take my kudos back from Barry. If he, you know what I'm saying?
Don't take your kudos back from Barry. But they will get to that framing.
Okay.
They will get to that framing, and I know that Bob is working on it. I know that other agencies are working on it, but they will get there. It is no different than the work that is being done in Representative Wesson's committee, who's doing the same thing, looking at the Oregon Health Plan.
I'm talking about him too, Madam Chair. So if you don't mind, I'll take a three-minute break.
Can you take a three-minute break?
Yeah, I'll
okay.
take a
three-minute
break.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, this has been an interesting discussion from this perspective. I don't think that accountability and measurement is only for good times. It's also to give us some indication during the bad times, not unlike vital signs, which I've been told by my physician friends aren't all that vital anyway. But we have selected a handful of indicators that will give us an early warning about what's happening in this changing environment. But the model is there, whichever direction the budget moves, so that you have the information you need to know how the performance is. And if we have more resources, our goals can be increased. If our resources decline, we need to recognize that and make our expectations realistic, as you pointed out. And we're prepared to tie those priorities to specific goals. What we can't do, I think, is pretend that we're able to do that with only those resources. Mm-hmm. And as long as we have that, I think those two things synchronized, we'll be able to tell the truth to each other and make better decisions.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm going to add another piece. I think sometimes, and I've noticed going through this process this time in the building, it also can sometimes lend itself to opportunities that you didn't have before. And, you know, I'm very mindful of the work that's being done with the county partners and the providers, and everyone's coming to the table to really work together to make sure that we do keep a system and structure in place. So I don't want at all to seem that it's negative, because it's not. I do think that there is the real desire in this building among legislators and the executive branch of government, as well as our partners, to actually work towards solutions. And so I think those are very positive developments.
Madam Chair, before I leave the state hospital issues aside, I want to just put a placeholder here. Dr. Mazerhart is with us and is going to talk a little bit about how the state hospital has been performing. We actually have some good news today, and I'll let him announce that. But I think one of the things that has happened as a result of the 1988 Commission report and the activities, it has allowed the state hospital to concentrate on parts of its treatment system that it didn't have as much of an opportunity to focus on when it had to do everything from acute care to long-term care. And I'll let Dr. Mazerhart talk about that more, but I wanted to leave a placeholder for that. I'd be remiss in not acknowledging that there have been some difficult things happening in the community mental health system. I would just say Multnomah County has been a source of concern for many, many years. I think in the last 2 years, we've begun to turn a large and difficult system around. I think it would be a tragedy if we weren't able to continue that in many ways, because a lot of the models that Dr. Davidson and others have been working to create there are beginning to show promise. But it's true that the Multnomah County system, and because it's about 30% of our community system, it's sort of hard to talk about the state of the state without mentioning Multnomah County. But I do think that there's been some real signs of improvement and beginning to turn things in the right direction. Dr. Davidson and others are the first to acknowledge that they're 1 year really into that process, and it probably would take another couple of years to really see the full advantages bloom from that.
As I understand Dr. Davidson's comments, they're twofold. Is one that, retooling the system, if you will, but also with doing with less dollars. And that he really believes that the outcomes are more effective. So that was kind of
interesting in hearing Dr. Davidson. Here you had a crisis, and someone came in and looked at that crisis and said, how can we do it better within the resources and restructure? And I really, you know, looking at the continuum model that he's talking about and how that works for Multnomah County, I think it bears us to really to continue to support and watch it.
Madam Chair,
Representative Westland.
If I could, I just read in the paper this morning where, and this is very good news for everyone in Oregon, really, where Dr. Davidson and Cascadia is going to be able to continue on a month-to-month basis. And that's not with additional dollars. That's what was, you know, a very reduced sum of money that some of the efficiencies he's able to wring out of the system and the outcome-based, in other words, don't get the patients coming back through. Again, very good news for Oregon on those very reduced dollars. What looked like, you know, the projected outcomes, he was only going to be able to go through the end of February. They're able to extend again at least another 30 days. So, I mean, that I think that says a lot in and of itself, and I think that is very good news for a lot of individuals in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would just say that a lot of the things that we're learning in Multnomah County are things that are being applied in other counties as well. And I think the probably the quickest way to think about it is that what I can't speak for Dr. Davidson, but a lot of what he's doing fits under the category of evidence-based practices. He's doing things that really we've known for maybe not for 50 or 100 years, but we've known for long enough to do many of the things that Dr. Davidson is suggesting. And I do want to point out that the mental health directors have been very interested in moving more and more of their services in that same kind of direction to the degree that they're not already there. There are some programs that have gone that direction quite a long ways. Josephine County is an example. And there are pockets of excellence in many of the other programs around the state.
You mentioned that what he's doing now is evidence-based practice. Can you share with us from a historic perspective what's taken us so long to get there?
Madam Chair, I think that's the $1 billion question in some ways. I think my own view on this, and it's something that I've been pretty involved in, is that what we're really talking about is culture change. We have changed cultures in a number of programs, and a lot of the programs want to do that. What they're finding is that it's not as simple as just declaring that they're now in an evidence-based practice mode. It's not always just a question of resources either. A lot of times people say, and I'll speak from my own personal experience at the University of Kansas, where I got my master's degree in social work, I learned very little about what I actually learned to do in the real world when I began to work with people with alcohol and drug programs, problems, and mental health issues, particularly chronic mental illnesses. Too many graduate schools probably still are focused too much on kind of a private practice model, and a lot of people go to graduate school to move into to a very different world than they find when they get into the what I consider to be the real world of community mental health. And so it's changing people's expectations about what they were trained to do, giving them new skills. There are also administrative and regulatory changes that we have to have the courage to make as a state, and we need to be looking at all the different levels of influencing a system, from training to preparation to administrative rules to resources, contracting.
Is there, and you make an interesting point when you talk about from the education community and what you were trained to do versus the real world, is there a disconnect between the actual application and practice and the theory and what happens in the university systems?
I'm sure that would probably be a topic for hours of discussion and review.
I raise that because not only this field, I think what you raised, has its implication, but other fields as well. If I look at the School of Social Work and what happens actually in practice versus what happens in the theory, and so
Madam Chair, just in the last couple of weeks, we've begun to make some inroads. We've begun some discussions with the Portland State University School of Social Work, Graduate School of Social Work. There are a couple of community colleges, Rogue Community College in particular, and we're having very good discussions with them about how we can develop evidence-based practice courses and tracks, maybe even someday a certification process. That's probably getting way ahead of ourselves, but we are beginning to have what I consider to be some good beginning discussions about these with some of the publicly funded higher education institutions.
I think that both Senator Gourley and I have been very concerned when you deal with the issue of cultural competency, particularly when you talk about the various cultures of ethnic cultures, and where most of the educational systems do not take those kinds of things into consideration when they're doing their teaching, and so that student then goes out into the community with one set of norms or one set of theory to find that those really aren't accurate, and because that hasn't been included. And I would think in the field of mental health as well as in some of the others that you can make some misdiagnosis when you're talking about dealing with certain groupings, because what would be norm to them would not be norm to someone else. And this educational piece has been one that both the senator and I have been very concerned about for some time.
I think just to conclude some of the thoughts about how the mental health system is performing, again, this is something that I'm sure there will be more questions about. We are looking at the performance measures in the model that you see on page 4-20. Some of the keys there are really tracking better how we're doing around readmission data. There are beginning to be benchmarks that we can look at and compare like programs to like programs about how often or how frequently within what period of time people have to be readmitted to that level of care. So I think we're moving in the right direction there. We're also now beginning to provide quarterly reports to the counties so they can begin to see how they're stacking up in comparison to statewide averages and to any benchmarks that we're able to come up with.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask a question that probably relates to what you're talking about as well. What you're covering right now is kind of waiting for you to get through this. The outcome data we look at is what we see here, sort of statewide, 80,000 feet look at this. But because of the work we've done in Representative Westland's committee and the night work down there, the long meetings we've had, we've come to the realization that county by county and program by program, there's wide variations. And we've not had a chance to see the outcome variations from those programs, if in fact they exist, which I assume they do. Dr. Davidson stands out because he believes in a community-based program for the very reasons the chair here has discussed it, because those communities vary by so much you have to have programs that are appropriate for that community. He believes in a wraparound service so that the patient has services not just in the hospital with a disconnect going to the community health center or community mental health center. That patient's monitored daily if necessary, has housing if necessary. Someone checks to make sure they take their medication every day, phone call or visit every day to make sure they if things are going right, or if not, less than that. And when I listen to that program as a provider in a part of the state that doesn't have that kind of program, I think of the people in our community who frequently arrive at the emergency room in a crisis, who often are admitted to hospital for a period of time and go back out in the community with no real follow-up other than a note saying, go to this community health center on Monday, and with no way of following up or getting there or making sure they're taking their medications. We often call them frequent flyers at the emergency room because they're there so often, everybody knows them as soon as they come in. And he seems to have gotten around that with his wraparound services. Josephine County seems to have done that too. So the question we're leading up to here, this great variation in programs around the state, have we been able to demonstrate not only a decrease in hospitalization, but a better quality of life for these people? So they have more of a real life out there in their communities, living semi-independently or even independently, depending on how well they're doing. Have you had a chance to break that down yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think those are the very questions that we need to be moving toward answering in a better way. We have been out and we've been doing our site reviews. There was a period of time when we were having trouble even keeping up with that. But the site reviews, in my opinion, we need to take the next step in the next 2 years if we have an opportunity to do that, and assuming that the resource level allows us to really measure some of these things. We need to think about how close to evidence-based practices, the kind of things like wraparound services for kids and adults, we're coming out there and help programs really begin to assess where they are on that continuum. One of the ideas that we can talk about for site reviews is there's a term called fidelity scales, which comes out of some of the work that we're involved with New Hampshire Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center. Fidelity scales are easy to measure objective scales that allow you on 10 to 20 different dimensions to judge a program based on how it fits given certain criteria that are in these fidelity scales. You come up with an overall score which tells you you're 70% there or 80% there or 50% there. I think there are ways to use some of these fidelity scales in the near future to see where programs are at and help them begin a self-assessment process. And we've also talked with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill about whether the local chapters would like to become involved in helping look at their local community programs. We've talked about these ideas, and these are things that I think would help us move in the kind of directions that Dr. Davidson is talking about.
I'm surprised Dr. Bates didn't broach our favorite subject from last session. And that was last session, one of the things that we asked all of the agencies to come forward with was performance-based outcomes. And our member who was no longer with us, and we promised her that we would not, and I personally promised her that I would continue to emphasize the work that she in this building has asked of every agency. Because one of the budget drivers, you know, we come every session and we hear what's going on, but we kind of would like to know, you know, the specific performance and what's worked and whether, and whether or not the patient is getting well, whether or not, and because as we look at the resources, you're able to do a much better job of deploying resources if you know that kind of information. And Senator Yee isn't with us, but Senator Yee, wherever you are, we're not going to let up on performance-based outcomes. And so when you come back with the rankings, I would ask you to also come back with your outcomes that tell us, since it's been 2 years since we were here, what has happened in mental health and what has happened in alcohol and drugs. Who have you served? How have you served them? What have been the results of the service that you have rendered? We also ask you to make sure that the contracts that you were entering into with your providers, that those contracts also were performance-based, so that you were linking the data or the information from your provider back to the state agency. And I do hope that somewhere in this presentation that you're able to give us some of that information so that we're able to really talk about that it's working. And that doesn't, for me, if it's not working, tell us it's not working. But certainly we need to have some way of doing an analysis and assessment of what is occurring and beyond the antidotes. We all know that we have a tremendous problem. We all know we have a number of people who need our service, and I guess we want to know what's happening at the end of the tunnel. And if nothing's happening at the end of the tunnel, I think we want to know that too. And if there's barriers to us getting there, we want to know that too. But I do want to keep up the mantle for Senator Yee, wherever you are, Senator Yee, and I hope you're listening today.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, wherever you may be, I'd like to call your attention to page 4-21 and 4-22, because that I think begins to get at the issue you're raising, Madam Chair. You can see where we're at. We're still in development in terms of a good measure of the percent of consumers who are involved in community activity. We now have fiscal year 00 and fiscal year 02 data on percent of consumers who maintain or improve their level of functioning, and you can see it's 90.6% for 2000, and it's 92% for fiscal year 02. These are based on self-reports, and I think there's always room to question whether this is the best report or not, valid questions, but I think we're at least beginning to move in that kind of direction, and happy to talk further about how these measures look to the committee, demonstrating the effectiveness of community care by the measure of percent of consumers who are readmitted to hospital or acute care within 180 days of discharge. We have figures now for the year 2000 and 2002, and I won't walk you through each one of these, but I think this is beginning to get at those kinds of questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates, I don't want him to make sure he has time for Mazur Hart to give his presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, you have several measures here that are really quite objective. Decrease in hospitalization rates, which has not changed in 2 years, basically. Those receiving community services in 7 days after hospital. I mean, there are some things that are very objective you can measure. And I'd like to see if you could break those down by program sometime, different counties, different programs, see where we're moving, if we are.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I believe that we can do that, and I'll go back and see whether we can bring that to the committee here in the next couple of days.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just one comment in response to Representative Bates' concern about variation. When the legislature established a mental health system for the state, it was clear in the statute that the local mental health authority was county government. And we repeatedly come to you and talk about our county partners. But we have a dual role with counties. We're there to assist and to help, and we're in partnership and all of that, and we're also there to regulate and hold accountable. And I think it would be unfair to say that what's happened in Multnomah County, which has been a dramatic move in the right direction, happened without the state behaving in its appropriate statutory role. That is, we went, and I'm not talking just about Bob and me, but about the former governor, and actually met with the board and said, we can't continue to operate this way. The risks, the costs are too great. So there is variation among the counties, as there is in medicine and surgery, variations in regionally. And you talked about Dartmouth. Dr. Winberg's analysis of that really was eye-opening about why certain surgeries are performed more. And it's the same thing in mental health, only mental health has a more amorphous kind of enterprise, as Representative Westland pointed out. So what we've been doing for a number of years is to try to bring those variations down, to get agreement about what a consensus about what kinds of problems we're going to deal with and what kinds of approaches make sense, and then measure whether people are implementing what they know works. And I think over time, that strategy, rather than a command and control strategy, will produce the kinds of results we want. But in the meantime, we can produce those data by county, and actually on the web we have a lot of information county by county that tells you how community programs are performing. Okay. We're with you on this.
Perhaps I can wrap up my part here for the time being by just pointing to page 423, and for the problem gambling components of our office, we have a similar kind of performance measure model. I won't walk through it in detail. You may notice, if you look at it carefully, yes, on page 4-24, that there's been a decrease in percent of clients who report higher quality of life. And I understand, in asking a little further about that, what happened? Did we begin, and also the percent of clients with reduction of elimination of problem gambling, why were there reductions there in the scores? And I'm told that we changed the way we measured that, and I can get more detail for you on that, but it's I was a little concerned when I saw the drop-off, partly because We have a nationally, if not internationally, recognized approach to problem gambling. Our problem gambling manager, Dr. Jeff Murata, was in New Zealand recently and was presenting there, and he's acknowledged as an international expert. So I can go back and get more detail about why some of the performance measures looked like they dropped, but I'm told there was a change in how we collected and understood the data.
Senator Carter.
We had the lottery this week, and this question was asked in the lottery in terms of the way the questions have been posed, and so we are asking for him to come to the Economic Development Committee to discuss this, because we see where the lottery is mandated to give so much money for gambling addiction, and we understand that those dollars pass through from them to you. And when we look at the behavior of gambling, gamblers in this state, and we see the high incidences of those who are identified as problem gamblers, we're just trying to find out, number one, the effects that the counseling is having upon them, and are we seeing higher levels of numbers as a result of what is happening, and if those dollars truly were affected, Madam Chair, by the budgets by the budget in their committee. Is the legislature taking those dollars once the lottery department passed them on to your division in terms of dealing with the issue of problem gambling?
You mean, are they going into the general fund pot and not getting to where they're supposed to be going?
Okay. So that is not.
She's dreaming in color right now.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter,
Ben gave me some cream to put on.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Thank you, Bob.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I do want to call your attention to the fact that in 1998 we served 861 problem gamblers, and this past biennium we jumped up to 1,651. So there's been a doubling in increase in access to problem gambling treatment. I think that's reassuring to us that we are moving in the right direction again by getting outreaching and getting more help to people who are struggling with
that. Bob, my question would be a person who used to work with statistics, and you said you changed something in the gathering of statistics, because I know we can kind of make them do what we want them to make them do. I want to know what changes that you made. And having said that, I would like that when we're doing statistical fact-finding gathering, at some point, that when we come up with our model or the questions that we're going to ask, that we, you know, keep consistent on the course, because once you change in midstream, you do skew your outcome data, and you know, because you've changed your mission.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just a little comment, Bob, that any of the agencies that are listening.
Madam Chair, I fully recognize that too, and certainly in this one we couldn't be accused of making ourselves look better, because we looked a lot worse in that process.
But even looking worse, I mean, that's a really high. You know, when you change your methodology, it skews your data.
At this point, I'd like to ask Dr. Stan Mazurhart.
I think Senator Carter has a question.
Mr. Naughton, a question. Did the governor's office capture any of the dollars that would pass through from the lottery to DHS for problem gambling?
Madam Chair, I am not aware that any of that money was diverted from the problem gambling program, but lottery funds are not my primary area of expertise, so I can check into that.
I'd appreciate that a lot.
Well, let's see.
Because those are mandated dollars, Madam Chair.
It went up. Turn to page 425.
Okay.
So then you'd have to go back and look at overall how much and what the percentage was, but this shows that it went up.
Okay.
I think he's going to call for Stan to come. Are you going to call for Stan to come up?
Yes.
Dr. Mazurhart will now come and talk to you a little bit about the performance of the state hospitals, and if it's acceptable, I think we should try to keep moving along. Stan, Dr. Mazehart will also talk with you a little bit about how funds are actually used within the state hospital system. That will then lead into, if there's not time today, tomorrow, hopefully we can talk about how funds are used in the community system for addictions and mental health and gambling addiction treatment. And finally, we'll conclude with what can be expected from what we know at this point of the governor's balanced budget.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Stan Mazehart, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. And I'm going to talk today about both the Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center a bit as well in terms of both the state hospitals. I would like to begin by kind of attending to that which Bob Nickel and Barry Cast have said relative to the Governor's Commission and the changes in the role of the state hospital over the past 12 years or so. I was fortunate enough to be a member of that commission, and I think that the commission and all of the members set a much better direction than we had experienced before relative to state hospital operations, particularly around the issue of acute care and folks being able to receive inpatient treatment services closer to home in a community setting. At the same time, the hospital has retained one of its critical functions, I suppose, of being the safety net in which folks who have had difficulty making it elsewhere after acute care have been able to be admitted. One of the things that I would point out in the beginning is that we refer to the state hospitals as kind of homogeneous entities, that it's kind of one program and one group of folks and one set of criteria, and it really isn't. It's four different treatment program areas, as I'll quickly explain, between Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. Oregon State Hospital operates two campuses, one in Salem and one in Portland, and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, of course, is in Pendleton. We serve approximately 700 patients on a daily basis, and between the two hospitals, there are 1,397 employee positions and 1,321 FTE. The state hospitals are a critical part of a continuum of mental health services, as has been described already in testimony from Bob Nickel. That continuum ranges from crisis services and acute hospitalization to an intermediate and long-term hospitalization at the state hospitals to residential and outpatient treatment services in the community. As a part of a subset of the responsibilities that the state hospital has in its service area is the issue of public safety, particularly as it results to statutes surrounding our forensic treatment programs. Both Eastern Oregon State Hospital and Oregon State Hospital provide psychiatric services for Oregonians who suffer from severe and persistent mental illness and need a longer-term, more intensive level of care to recover sufficiently to live in less structured community settings. Many of these people also have significant legal issues. There are four clinical treatment program areas, if you will. One is for adults who are civilly committed to the state's care and treatment. And Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center operates 60 beds on two wards, and Oregon State Hospital operates, for adult services, 68 beds on three wards. We also operate an adolescent treatment services program, which is 40 beds. Bob mentioned earlier that those are individuals 18 through 17 years of age. That's 40 beds on two wards. We have a geropsychiatric treatment program, which has 114 beds on four wards, and we have a forensic treatment services that right now operates 374 beds as budgeted on 11 wards. The individuals in these programs, which are a total of 721 beds on 24 wards, come to us as mandated caseload, either through civil commitment, through juvenile court order, through a voluntary admission by guardian, a transfer from the Oregon Youth Authority. On under a statute, ORS 161370, which commits a person for treatment until they're able to aid and assist in their own defense, proceed and cooperate with counsel, and then a large number of folks who are have been placed under the Psychiatric Security Review Board because they have committed a crime that is seen as the product of their mental illness. Our forensics program right now, which is the largest program, has 79 individuals, as of Monday of this week, 79 individuals under Oregon Revised Statute 161.370, which is the aid and assist statute. Under the Psychiatric Security Review Board, we have 312 individuals, and there are 11 civilly committed individuals in forensics, which is a total forensic population of 402 inpatients in 374 budgeted beds. So we are 28 folks over budgeted capacity at this time. The number of folks served in this current biennium, 0103, between Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center and Oregon State Hospital, projected based on actuals through the month of February this year, are 2,500. Approximately, with a admission rate of approximately 791 and a discharge rate of 843. The length of stay, which is always of interest to folks, shows huge variability and is difficult to capture in simply averages. But I would say that it ranges from 78.5 days at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center through approximately 1,500 days in our longer-term forensics programs. From that, I would like to move to accomplishments of the state hospitals through the 0103 biennium. First and foremost is the fact that we have managed a very difficult census problem, particularly in our forensic treatment services, and the hospital has been able to meet the demands of that census process, of that census problem. Also, during this biennium, we opened a new forensic ward to help with the caseload growth around individuals committed to us for treatment until able to aid and assist in their own defense. We did that in November of 2001. Also, the hospital closed the ward, Ward 40A, which Bob Nickel referenced earlier, and that was a very positive outcome of some significant planning in the Office of Mental Health Services, Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and community partners and the state hospital, so that the youngest of children for whom we had been providing services at a state hospital level don't have to be in the state hospital to receive the services to meet their clinical needs. And that was done about a year ago. That was closed. In addition, during this biennium, we have maintained our here's where I run into a lot of acronyms, so be careful. I've been in the audience and been duly warned. What is referred to as the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which I would parenthetically say, having explained it, is seen as CMS at times, and which was formerly the Healthcare Finance Administration. We maintain certification in our distinct part at OSH and on our two adult wards at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center.
Yeah, he just said OSH. That's right. Yes, he just heard it. Margaret isn't here, but Dr.
I heard it had to be bills on top of it. Go for it. And as a matter of fact, this week, and Bob referenced this earlier, we had the privilege and honor of being surveyed by the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services. We had a full-blown survey. They showed up on Monday morning at 8:30 in my office, unannounced as they do nowadays. And this was to look at services provided on our adolescent wards and our geropsychiatric treatment wards, which received for this biennium about $26 million in federal funds for their operation. They left this morning at 9:30 with an exit conference, and in that exit conference, they noted that there were no deficiencies in their report to the federal government, which in my memory, is a first for the Oregon State Hospital following a survey by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So the hospital staff have done a very good job, excellent job, in maintaining that. And those standards of participation refer to staffing levels, active psychiatric treatment, and standards around seclusion and restraint, which is an added standard over the past few years. We hadn't been surveyed there in 5 years. We've also maintained our JCHO accreditation at OSH during this biennium.
Accreditation of hospitals, Madam Chair.
You know, it's kind of... how fair it is, I kind of feel that with the physician on this panel, he knows exactly where I'm going to trip up on which acronyms, as a matter of fact. So, but I'll just leave my wallet out at this point. We have met the necessary licensing and regulatory requirements at both Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center.
Dr. Macehart, did Bob have you come up so that he knew that you were going to do that and that you would pay?
I don't know, but I didn't see how much you've put in so far.
Madam Chair, it just shows the excellent coordination between the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the state hospital system.
He's good, Bob. Stan, you better take some lessons.
I'm going to. let me see. Now. The fifth area of accomplishment, I think, is more effective working between the Office of Mental Health Services, the state hospitals, both, and community partnerships and community mental health programs, which is an ongoing tug as there have been budget reductions and changes in programming, and I think that that has worked very well as an accomplishment. Finally, in a sixth area I would like to mention to you is an area that I like to think of as progress toward accomplishment. I don't consider it an accomplishment at this point in time, but that is during the past year the Oregon State Hospital has worked on issues of increasing the clinical cultural competence of the staff employed at the hospital and to be more respectful and appreciative of both the patients whom we serve and one another within the workforce. As I said, I don't consider this an accomplishment, but I want to bring it to your attention as a significant effort that the hospital is making and will continue to make until we can report back to you that we are successful in a very significant way beyond where we are now. It's a growth process or an improvement process. From there, I would like to talk about... if I can jump back to another accomplishment that we've had is that we had a significant reduction in our medication error rate during this past biennium. We're a member, the state hospitals both, Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center and Oregon State Hospital, are both members of the Western Psychiatric State Hospital Association. By short straw, I happen to be president of that right now. And in the last meeting that we, at the last meeting that we had, Oregon State Hospital was recognized for best practices around the reduction of its medication error rate. We have an error rate of 1.4 incidents per 1,000 patient hours versus a high in like hospitals in the Western region compared to about 17 other state hospitals of 8.96 per 1,000 patient hours. We'd like to get it to zero and are continuing to work on that.
Could you elaborate on what's involved in creating the error rate?
Yes, Madam Chair. It relates to prescribing, dispensing, and administering are sort of the three steps in the process. And one is that the prescription is written as intended and a mistake doesn't occur, and that can occur in terms of number of milligrams or how the medication is to be administered, so that the prescription is written correctly and it's read correctly by the pharmacy, and the pharmacy, in taking that off, puts the medicine together for, if you will, transport to the patient in an accurate manner, and then that whoever is responsible, whether it's a certified medication aide or a registered nurse, that they administer the medication as it has been prescribed and account for that administration correctly. An error, as you can imagine, can occur anywhere along that line. And this is a sum total of all of the errors that occur along that line without differentiation as to which particular point they occur.
Do you have a, in looking at prescription, the prescriber is normally the doc, and then you have the pharmacist who is the one who fills it, and then you may have somebody else dispense it. And I know when we're talking about fee for service and some of the other kinds of programs that we have where we're looking at such issues as multiple drugs or maybe too many are being given, some of those kinds of issues. Are you doing that as well at the state hospital? And what process do you use to monitor the drugs?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do. The medical staff has what is called a medical department quality improvement program, in which there's a peer review process by which charts are regularly pulled at random, and a group of physicians sits down and goes through those charts and looks at the prescribing practices as well as the rest of the treatment plan and program that's being done by the attending physician. And feedback is provided as a result of that peer review process. We also do what are called drug utilization evaluations or drug utilization reviews, which are studies on particular drugs to determine their efficacy, rate of prescribing, outcomes. Those kinds of variables are looked at around any number of drugs. At the state hospital, the majority of drugs looked at, of course, are antipsychotic medications, but the medical staff has also looked at some antibiotics and other drugs as well. And those, I might add, that those studies are then cataloged and reported to the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations when we are surveyed.
Do you have, when I worked the med school, a few years ago, there used to be, in order to keep our accreditation, there was an independent group who came in from out of the state who went did the record reviews and those kinds of things. Is that how your peer review is done, or is it done internally?
We have, Madam Chair, we have three major bodies that come in and look at us in a clinical review sense. One is the one that just finished today, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. That survey team, for example, was composed of a psychiatrist, board-certified psychiatrist, a nurse practitioner, and a licensed social worker. And they just came in and looked at the distinct part in this regard. The Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations comes in and also looks at the clinical program. We're reviewed every 3 years. We have full accreditation status for the entire hospital. We're looking at a December 03 this year, 3-year accreditation survey that we're in the middle of preparing for. Those survey teams tend to be a board-certified psychiatrist, a nurse, and an administrator. Sometimes the administrator position is filled by a licensed social work position in our case, and they look at standards for hospital care and behavioral health care. We also have a physician review group from outside, and
Thank you,
gosh,
we're
going
to invite you back.
I have to admit, I'm drawing a complete blank. It's OMPRO. I had to do it, but I have to be paid. OMPRO, which is a physician peer review group, basically, that the mental health The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services contracts with the state hospital as part of that, and they come in and review treatment plans, physician interactions, prescribing, and those things. It's a professional medical peer review group that we contract with.
We contract with them. They just, it's not just they.
Right. They contract with hospitals in Oregon, different providers, where we're required to show, particularly in our case, what they look at are continued stay criteria. So where whether or not there is justification for a person to remain in the hospital having been there a certain period of time.
Thank you.
Yes. The last accomplishment that I wanted to mention is that there's been talk, there was talk earlier about employment, and we see, as does the mental health treatment community, employment as a critical part of success in recovery, that we all kind of define ourselves in what we do and what our work is, and that's a common trait in this society, and that to be able to provide work for people and to be able to help people in their own recovery and in their own self-determination go down the road of employment and to pick that piece in their life back up is a critical factor. We have established employment opportunities through our vocational services department for over 240 patients in the hospital, and this ranges from our wood product shop that we transferred to Oregon State Hospital from Vocational Services Division a number of years ago, now I guess 10 years ago. We have bench work. We have work in the kitchen where we have a patient pay program and in other areas of the hospital. So both as to learn skills and to have work and to be able to spend critical time in employment and being able to earn money.
Stan, is that your woodworking shop, and I did tour that, I think, a couple of sessions ago. Is it still self-supporting?
For the most part, it is. It kind of waxes and wanes across the biennium depending on contracts and availability of folks who can handle that kind of work. But what we do is when we have fewer patients who can do that kind of work, then the staff do the work to keep up with the contract so that we don't lose those contracts.
And you're still doing lawn furniture?
Yes, we are. Adirondack Furniture.
That's what those members here, if you...
It's very, very high-quality stuff that any person in Oregon can put in an order for, and we do it custom.
For members who have not taken a tour, and I'm sure that Dr. Mazerhart will be very happy to take you through the facility, and there is a woodworking shop, and they do manufacture, and they do sell. That's why I asked the question if it was being self-sustaining, and I did know that they did do lawn furniture. So tell your friends and others.
Madam Chair, thank you for the advertisement, in fact. Appreciate that.
Well, Rosie likes it, and, it's all a part of the programs that we have to assist each other. So.
Indeed. I would like to just then mention performance measurement, which is a critical part of how we do business. We talked about how some of our performance is measured, and we also participate. And this one, I'd like to I appreciate being able to contribute to Rosie, but the following is an acronym that has no meaning whatsoever, honestly. But you're going to pay for it anyway. And that's called ORYX, O-R-Y-X, and it's a program established by the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. No one really knows where or how they got the name. I guess it's the name of a gazelle. But in any case, what it refers to is a program whereby hospitals have to enter a data pool nationwide to be able to measure themselves against what national norms are in particular areas of medical care. In a general hospital, these would be surgery areas and radiology and other specializations. In psychiatric hospitals, this was picked up for public psychiatric hospitals by the National Research Institute, which is part of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. And that program includes something like 220 public psychiatric hospitals around the country, actually more than public psychiatric hospitals. And we have six performance criteria in those, 30-day readmission rate, an elopement rate, restraint hours, percent of clients restrained, seclusion hours, and percent of clients secluded. We provide data to the National Research Institute on a monthly basis, and they give us back reports that indicate where Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center and where Oregon State Hospitals stack up in those on those measures. To us, seclusion and restraint is critical. It's critical for a lot of different reasons. First and foremost is that in a patient's recovery, which has a strong emphasis on self-determination, we should be working with folks to be able to manage their own behavior and not manage it externally or mechanically in some way wherever possible. It's also, quite frankly, seclusion and particularly restraint leads to a lot of safety issues and potential injuries for patients and staff both. So that's another reason why we want to stay away.
Could you do two things for me? One, provide this panel with the results of the report.
Yes, I
because
would.
I'm sure that they're going to ask that question. And two, you mentioned the all probability or possibility of increase in injuries and things to staff as a result of the restraint requirement. Could you provide us with the change, if you will, in your what's happening with your safe claims? You know, if they're going up or what's happening? Because if you're having, for example, more injuries to staff, you know, then that means that we have more other problems with staff. So I think that this panel needs to have that kind of information as we do budgets.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to. That's very important data to us as well, as you indicate. And the third area that I wanted to say about why we would want to see the reduction here is that restraint can be a very traumatic, psychologically traumatic event, which is particularly difficult for folks who have experienced sexual or physical abuse in a prior time in their life. And so there are all kind of reasons why we want to reduce and get to the point of eliminating restraint. I'm happy to report to you, we just actually got today. Today's a kind of day of a couple of good news things for us, at least. And that is that we got the report for February today, and we are now on all six of these measures below the national average, which is where you want to be, below the national average in all of these measures. And they provide for us both a table data and graph data, and I will get copies of this for the entire committee. I would also say that we've looked at, and that's on all of those measures that I had mentioned, that we've also looked ourselves at seclusion and restraint as a critical critical issue over the past 10 years. Of course. Oh, I put it up here. Excuse me. And we've looked at this over the last 10 years in terms of reduction of seclusion and restraint hours per average daily population. And this, though it's at a distance, gives you a feel for how we've been able to reduce our seclusion and restraint.
I have to admit I don't have my glasses on.
Well, it looks very good, actually. But rather than take my word for it, what I'll do is I'll attach that to the packet of.
If you say it's going down, I will believe it's going down.
We are headed down.
Senator Gordley.
Madam Chair, I have one other request as well of Dr. Mazurhart. We had a very good meeting up in my office just a few days ago, which was focused on the action plan that's underway. Focused on cultural diversity and clinical cultural competence. Some good steps are being taken, and I think Dr. Mazurhart understands that we just need to have an even greater sense of urgency around the work. But I think for the knowledge of the committee, it would be good if you could provide a copy of the plan and give everyone an idea of what is underway. And I'm sure that there may be members on the committee who want to weigh in.
Madam Chair, Senator Gourlay, I'd be most pleased to do that.
Thank you.
And I guess that kind of gets to the point at the end of the presentation regarding the state hospitals. I would say that during 0102, so far 0103, Oregon State Hospital, the budget at the hospital has been reduced to about $2.2 million. That's far less a percentage than has been reduced in the state hospitals. And when we've talked about the relative percentage of the budget, state hospital versus community programs, I think it's critical to emphasize that there's been some huge losses in the community. There have been some losses in the state hospital, but that disparity change isn't because of growth anywhere, really, in the sense that the system has been hurt dramatically, and particularly around crisis services, and therefore then the ability of acute care services and eventually the state hospital and the adult side to be able to provide adequate services. Our forensics, we closed one forensics ward and have delayed the opening of another until hopefully sometime in the next biennium, which has left us 28 folks over our budgeted capacity in forensics, which is a issue that we are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And that would end my comments, and thank you.
Thank you. Rosie certainly does appreciate your contributions today.
It's to a very good cause, and I'm pleased to be able to contribute.
Thank you. Senator Carter.
Is Barry going to respond to the reduction in governor's budget in terms of the eliminating of many of these programs?
In fact, as you probably know, the governor's going to recast. We will be getting this one. But, okay. So we will give them the opportunity then when the new budget comes forward.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned till tomorrow. Thank you.